So Tracy and I have this agreement that we can go to bed angry, but we at least have to touch toes. And so there was a few nights ago, I was so angry with her. And so she started going to sleep and I was sitting up and she was lying curled up and I just wanted to murder her. And and then I remembered our principle that we've at least got to touch toes. And I was still, you know, I could feel every core in my body just not wanting to do it. Mm. So I reached over and I grabbed her hand and I squeezed it. She squeezed it back and I felt this immediate relief. It all went away.
This is Pod Crushed,
the podcast that takes the sting out of rejection, one crushing middle school story at a time.
And where guests share their teenage memories, both meaningful and mortifying.
And we're your hosts. I'm Nava, a former middle school director.
I'm Sophie, a former fifth grade teacher.
And I'm Penn, a middle school dropout. We're just three Baha'is who are living in Brooklyn,
wanting to make stuff together
with a particular fondness for awkward nostalgia.
I struggle with nostalgia. I'm here for the therapy. Actually, today, you know how busy I am, guys. I'm consolidating my therapy into today's episode.
Sneaky, I like it.
You're laughing, but you're going to thank me later.
Can I tell you a funny story about therapy?
Please.
So for years in my marriage with David, I begged him to go to therapy, okay? Literally on my hands and knees.
But is it like him therapy alone or both of you?
Yeah, him alone.
You're like, I don't have the problem.
Like, please, for the love of God, go to a therapist. And he did. He tried six different therapists over the course of a couple of years. And I mean, they were real characters, okay? Yeah. Hilarious. None of them worked. He did a couple sessions with each one. They were all terrible. And finally, actually, Penn's wife, Domino, suggested a therapist to him. And obsessed with him.
Yeah.
Yes, he's obsessed with him. Now, this guy is like the third person in our marriage. He comes up all the time. I love him. I never met him. I love him. And now David is the biggest proponent of therapy. He tells all his friends. He gives his therapist number to all his friends.
And I love that.
I'm like on the sidelines, like, I created you. I did this for you.
Well, it sounds like Domino created.
Yeah. Sounds like Domino. You need some therapy. Yeah. So that's a God complex.
I have to have David weigh in on whether he agrees.
No, but I think you guys are going to love this episode. I think it's filled with a lot of gems.
So this week is pretty exciting. We're about 14 episodes in. And you guys have heard several guests, as well as us, the hosts, share stories of embarrassment, estrangement, misunderstanding, humor, isolation, heartbreak, the whole sort of gamut of human emotions. And what all of these stories have in common is that they take place at the crossroads of our relationships, all kinds of relationships, our peer relationships, our parental, and our romantic relationships.
So we are going to therapy. That's right. Our guest today is Dr. Stan Tatkin, a psychotherapist, a researcher, and a best-selling author whose work helps us understand all types of relationships in refreshingly clear and accessible terms. His practice ties together developmental neuroscience, attachment theory, and practical relationship counseling. And his books, I mean, I personally have read a couple of his books. I mean, you could read even just a page and glean a lot. I just find them incredibly helpful. I think, obviously, evidently millions of others have. So they're huge. They've earned him praise from everyone from Esther Perel to Alanis Morissette. And together with his wife, Tracy, who you'll hear about in our conversation together, Dr. Tatkin founded the PACT Institute to train clinicians in a psychological approach to couples therapy.
He's also someone who talks about an idea that resonated with a lot of listeners a few episodes ago when we talked to Mona Chalabi about the concept of tethering. Although I don't actually know if he used the word tethering or if I imagined it, but he talks about attachment theory. Dr. Tatkin is going to get into that in more depth today, so you guys won't want to miss that.
And coincidentally, today's listener-submitted story, which you'll hear at the end of the episode, is strikingly similar to Stan and Tracy's story that brought them together, so you're not going to want to miss that. Stick around.
Stan, there's so many places to start, but there's something that you have said that is resonating with me now more than ever. You talk about how the sort of individual progress, the kind of growth we all want to see in ourselves, is that the place to learn the most is in relationships. This idea that you need to sort of be alone to figure things out and then you'll be ready for a relationship. I suppose there might be, you know, some nuggets of wisdom to be had there. Certainly we all need to know independence and self-subsistence to some degree. We can't be like just enmeshed in codependency our whole lives. But you seem to say that like everything that you're trying to learn to be in a relationship, you can only learn in one. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's correct. We learn through the interactions with others. And many of the feelings and ideas we have are constructs that are interactional between other human beings. So the idea of you got to love yourself before you can be in a relationship doesn't hold water developmentally mm-hmm. because a baby doesn't love itself. A baby learns to love itself by being loved. And this interaction between self and other is constantly forming sense of self and sense of other. And that goes on throughout the lifespan. It continues. So we're always learning how to be better in relationship, and we're growing in complexity as our brain develops.
Just a dovetail in and out of what we try to deal in this podcast with is like, you know, the sort of formative identity gestation period of middle school, you know, 12, 13, 14-ish. What is happening there developmentally that's not happening before or after?
Well, middle school is a very tough time. It's a very tough time for everybody, not just the person who's in middle school, but for teachers, for their parents. It's a hard time because we're dealing with a brain change, as a brain upgrade at around preteen period, and then also adolescence proper. We know more, we see more, and because brain development isn't uniform, we don't exactly have the entire equipment available to understand what we're feeling. Mm. And so it's a wild ride. Emotions are high. We're kind of revisiting an earlier period of my parents, I need them, but they're idiots. They're incompetent, but I need them, but they're idiots. And so there's this constant conflict of wanting more independence, but still being dependent, wanting to belong and feeling very anxious about our own identity. And so this is a classic period, a tumultuous period for most, not all teenagers, but most. And it's a time of going under the radar, not wanting to be embarrassed. So the face begins to stiffen up, very different from when we're 7 or 8. We begin to hide. We don't want to show our cards. We feel a lot more shame and exposure. We're careful about how we appear to other people, friends in particular. And we stop talking to our parents. We stop talking, except to our friends. And that's where we start to feel a different kind of freedom, identity with our peer group, if we're lucky enough to fit in to a group. And so it's a really, really tough time. There's a lot of bullying in junior high. In fact, most of the bullying that occurs is in junior high, some in elementary school, and it should actually abate in high school. If it continues in high school, there's something usually else going on. Mm-hmm. But there is so much. I mean, I just remember my own experience, and I remember my first day in junior high, and some kid, you know, I was scratching myself, and some kid said, "Hey, look at him, he's picking his butt." That's my first memory of my first day.
Did somebody else hear and did it stick?
No, I remember it, so yes. I was very internal, and I was very shy, and I was very insecure. And so I kept to myself, and I had a life outside, which a lot of kids didn't have. I was in the music business, and so I was among adults doing something special, and that made me feel protected in some way, but alienated.
You were a drummer, right?
I was a drummer. Yeah.
Are you saying you were already like somewhat professional, semi-professional, or you were?
I was recording already with Capitol Records, and I was a studio player. I mean, as a kid, I didn't know anything, but you know, I was playing jazz. And so I felt special in some way, but that specialness wasn't real. It was a way to protect myself because I was awkward with kids my own age. And because I spent a lot of time with adults, I felt like I was an outsider, and I felt like I had something outside of school. But in school, I did not feel safe. I did not feel secure.
I heard you say, Stan, in an interview, that a question you'll commonly ask patients or clients is, what was your parents' relationship like? What are your memories of their relationship from before you were 12 or up until you were 12, like kind of your childhood? And that their answer to that will often give you a lot to go off of. And it made me wonder, how much of a role do you think our experiences and our memories from adolescence stick with us? How much do they inform who we are in our relationships as an adult?
All of it. The earlier the memories, the more formative they are. And a lot of our memories, when we study babies, of course, they're pre-verbal. And those memories, those experiences are through thousands and thousands of repetition of interactions. And those are formative in, again, in adaptation. So you watch a baby and the parents don't do any proximity seeking. They don't go and reach out their arms like the baby does, or they don't hold the baby for very long. The baby begins to adapt and stops looking for proximity and begins to adapt by not tolerating a lot of contact over time. So those experiences are formative in how we move toward and away from other people, mm-hmm. how we adapt to feel safe and secure, even if the environment isn't providing safety and security. So children will always make up the differences, the deficits for what isn't there, and create their version of safety and security. And that in itself is an adaptation, right? What I see between my parents is essential because it is theater, right? I'm watching a movie. I'm watching the only play I know. It is the interaction constantly between these two giants, these two gods. And I'm watching how they do business with each other. And I'm getting a sense by watching one partner interact with the other and seeing how the other reacts. So let's say I'm watching Nava react to Sophie and I'm watching Sophie react to Nava. I'm getting a sense of Nava through her partner. I'm getting a sense of Sophie through her partner. And that's how I get an idea of gender, sex, and regard. Yeah. So basically, I am going to do what I see. We are memory animals that unfortunately or fortunately are energy conserved, meaning we do the least amount necessary. So I'm always going to do what I know, and what I know is what I've experienced, unless I'm forced into a position to become self-aware or to understand something I'm not looking at. But mostly we don't care unless we're forced to do that. Mm. We're just going to do what we have experienced, especially under stress.
Interesting.
Mm. What I'm kind of hearing from you is like by the time you're already 12, 13, you're bringing like your home life to school and anticipating that. Isn't that right? I mean, something along those lines. You're already very shaped by what you have or and haven't had at home.
Our values are shaped still at home, even though we're rebelling against it. But research has proven that children, though they're rebellious in adolescence, even late adolescence, they still strongly carry their parental values. So you have this split, kind of, where I'm discovering myself anew in this new land of peer groups. And some of that is influenced by my family of origin, and some of that is being newly created. So I have the opportunity where I am sort of inventing myself, or in technical terms, individuating, becoming my own person. And all of this is happening through the slings and arrows of life and other relationships with teachers and our peers. We carry with us every experience that impacts us, and we're more triggered by the experience or the re-experience of something that reminds us of a painful event or positive event than we are by the actual person. And so we get confused by that sometimes. I've married my mother, I married my father, which is really not true. Our mate selection is by recognition and familiarity, but it's across a wide swath of experiences and people. It's not just two people. So we're building an ever complex populace in our head, or representation of these people. They're not the actual people. They're our representation of these people, which is formed by our mental capacity to understand those people. My understanding of an early friend who humiliated me, if I have no other contact with that friend, that experience is never updated, and I still see that person as I did when I was 12. Mm. I still see myself as that person when I was 12. And that experience remains preserved and it can be triggered because I haven't had repeated interactions that would correct or modify that other and myself in relationship to that person. So we have all these archaic memories of relationships that are frozen in time because they didn't continue as we became more complex to modify. And that's why we're kind of stuck with some of these injuries, because it was never repaired.
Mm-hmm. That makes me think of the power of an apology.
Boy, does it.
Right? Yes. I mean, it just makes it seem like the things that stick with us are those things that, as you say, got frozen, you know? Yeah. I mean, how frozen are, like when we think of middle school, it's just, it's all the things that are frozen. It's all the things that never got repaired, I feel like, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how many things happened to us and we didn't go to someone to talk about it, where they hugged us and said, oh God, I know what that's like. Mm-hmm. But we kept it to ourselves and we tried to deal with it ourselves. And therefore, we couldn't digest it. We couldn't metabolize it. And it sticks with us.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
So I was thinking about, you know, if a lot of sort of like our earliest memories are the most formative, and the people with whom who are forming those memories are also the people who gave us our like DNA. So basically our nature and our nurture are determined by the same sort of set of people. If someone is not thrilled with that, like if someone is unhappy with the parental model that they have, what are the tools and instruments that are at their disposal to sort of break certain cycles instead of is it predetermined that they're just going to keep playing out the same things? So I'm just curious from your perspective, what's predetermined? What do we have agency over? And what are the tools that we can draw on to exert our agency in healthy ways?
Well, there was a lot of sub questions in that question. So let me try to parse it. I met my wife in middle school, Tracy. And I had a huge crush on her. She never knew.
That's so cute.
We didn't get together until our early 40s.
Wow.
So we didn't have a love relationship, but she was a big part of my life in middle school and high school. So that's serendipitous, you know. We both believe that had we met, you know, in adulthood even earlier, we probably wouldn't have been right for each other. Mm. So timing was everything. Mm-hmm. And we're really very different people. What we share is a history and a culture. But because we're very different people, I don't know that we would have had the maturity early on to make it work. So a lot of that has to do with getting older and having agency, knowing we have agency. When we're younger, we don't have as much. So to answer one part of the question, nature always repeats itself. We don't have control over that. That's a fact, and there's no reason to blame ourselves or others for that. It's nature. Mm. We do have the ability to pick and choose to some degree what we don't want to repeat and how we want to do things that are better. And that's where a couple can decide what their culture is going to be instead of the one they grew up in, right? A relationship doesn't really exist in real life. It's an abstraction. It's in our heads, which is a cool thing that only human primates can do. But the question is what is in our heads the same, and do we agree on it? Mm. What is our relationship? What is it going to serve? And how are we going to build a culture that suits us both? A lot of us will, you know, judge our parents in a way that is not complex, that doesn't really look at them as whole human beings, as people who are simply repeating what they learned, and that our history is, you know, is basically handed down to us. Understanding that gives us a bigger picture of how we are and why we are. Most every day is automatic energy conserved, therefore memory run and recognition based. To expect us to remember everything and to change everything is just, I mean, that's perfectionism, you know, to a T. That's impossible. So I think a lot of this is understanding what we can and cannot do and give ourselves and each other a break. Mm-hmm. As adults, we decide together what is the right thing to do in any given situation when it's the hardest to do. Mm. Because to be sure, human beings will always do what's the easiest thing to do that feels the best. That's our nature state. Under stress, I'm going to do what serves my interests. Screw the union. I do what's in my interests. And that is self-destructive from a two-person system think. Mm-hmm. If we're interdependent, not codependent, we're a team, an alliance. That's what bonds us. Therefore, we have to look out for each other as a way to take care of ourselves. Otherwise, I hurt you, that's going to hurt me, that is self-destructive. It's a different way of thinking than the way we normally do. Now, unfortunately, the injustices and unfairnesses in our family get carried over to our adult lives. We do it automatically. We make society pay for the injustices of our parents or a family. That has to stop in couples because that creates a system that becomes too unfair, too unjust, too insensitive too much of the time and will dissolve all unions. Mm. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
People have to consciously decide how to do business with each other that is going to be fair and just, or they will go to war like all human beings.
This is where you link two-person systems, like a serious love relationship, to social justice, or in saying that basically, like, you know, two people together are the smallest building block of a society.
Yeah.
I personally love that.
Yeah, me too.
I think you love it because it's true. It's true. It is the smallest representation of a civilization. It has to operate on shared power and authority. Otherwise, people will start to screw each other. Mm. And we know this when building a community or a church or a temple or a business. But couples, for some reason, do not think about this. They, you know, it's a whole other world of separate fantasy of love and, you know, we're supposed to be together, soulmates.
Why do you think couples aren't thinking about this?
I think because there is no cultural, there's no legacy of teaching. There's no understanding that this is a separate society, a separate fiefdom that's operating under its own rules of being protective and its own interests, mutual interests, that has to be sustained. Fidelity has to be maintained. Otherwise, it cannot continue. It will fall apart. We have to put things in place to protect us from our impulses, our natural state of being reckless. Otherwise, it's the Wild West. And that's not what people think. They just don't. Mm. They think we'll work it out. You know, love will prevail. Attraction will continue. And none of that's true. Real governance is deciding to do the right thing when it's the hardest to do. That means setting the bar high, wanting the best and expecting the worst, and predicting and planning for that. We don't do that. And that is our failing, is that we just go on being, we take things for granted, operate automatically through our lives, never really paying attention because we don't have to until we have to. And oftentimes that's when it's too late. Mm. It's a good thing to know this because then it allows us to put guardrails in and to create principles or relationship ethics that are guardrails, that are frames for us to be free in and know our limits. Because if I do something that is that betrays you, it also is going to betray me. And nothing I can do to you won't come back at me in a two-person system. Nothing. And people whose lives depend on this know this. People who are, you know, in countries where bullets are flying over the head, they know this. People on the street, homeless and vulnerable, they know this. Cop car partners know this. People in, you know, in troops where their lives depend on each other know this. They're interdependent. Mm-hmm. They serve the group because the group serves their protection. Their life. It's a different way of thinking, but couples don't think that way, see? They think that coupling is a luxury, that interdependence is a luxury. It's a necessity because pair bonding started with human primates based on survival to protect ourselves from predators and the environment. So we group together. So it's always been mutual interest that kept us together, even though we're different. But as human beings, we have this energy-conserved way of dealing with life that makes everything easy and automatic. And so we imagine we're family. And of course, that's a mistake because family can get away with things. And family is unconditional. We forget that human pair bonding or unions in adulthood is absolutely conditional. Mm. And it must be. It must be to work.
There's something very powerful about that because so often we're saying like, I want people kind of imagine they're looking for unconditional love. And it's like, well, I mean,
that's childhood.
And often even childhood, I think maybe it's not demonstrated, it's not modeled, it's not offered as much as we just, I don't know, give lip service to.
From an attachment point of view, that's exactly how it should have been. Mm. So we have attachment realities, and then we have the realities of human interaction. Attachment reality is relationship has to come first above the self, above performance, above appearance. Relationship is everything. Mm. And that means that if you hurt, I hurt. If something is wrong between us, I am driven to repair because I cannot breathe. I cannot exist. I cannot do business today because things aren't right between me and you. Therefore, I have to do it. That's a relationship-centered world in attachment where I'm interested in you. I pay attention to you. I want to know you. I want you to perform. I want you to be successful, but not at the cost of the relationship. And so it's a different culture, and that's the way it's supposed to be, and that gets carried out through and spreads out to other relationships. It's what makes for people who are socially, emotionally intelligent. It what makes for power, because the most powerful people are the people that know how to work with a great swath of personalities and are able to bring them together and tolerate them. That's an attachment feat. That's, I feel safe and secure inside because my sense of connection, my secure base is solid in my head because I have that foundation.
Can we talk a little bit about codependency? Because sometimes I feel like that word is used just for like when someone is expressing like a genuine need for like validation or contact or communication and someone else is like, you're so codependent. Like I feel like people use it as a weapon to like bludgeon you when you're expressing like
and
a healthy desire.
The difference between codependency and interdependency. Because in my head, interdependency is a very positive thing. What's the difference?
Codependency originally started off as an AA or an Alcoholics Anonymous term that grew out of co-alcoholic, meaning there's an alcoholic and then there's a co-alcoholic who enables them. So I'm in a love relationship with my alcohol, and my partner is in a love relationship with my tendency to be in love with my alcoholism. Mm. And so we have two birds of a feather here that are in a non-reciprocal relationship. It's a one-way, one-direction relationship. Codependency is one direction only. It's not reciprocal. It's not collaborative. But it's been used to mean, you know, dealing with a narcissist, being a borderline, being a weak, you know, simp, being somebody who's clingy and overly dependent. Well, the fact of the matter is human primates are by nature dependent. We're dependency animals. That is just the way we are. Any other representation is an adaptation. So people who are religiously independent and autonomous are that way generally because their independence is confused with having been neglected on an attachment level. That's not real independence. Independence always grows out of full dependency on another person. Mm. And then we become autonomous creatures who are able to interdepend. Interdepend means that we have a central purpose or reason to depend on each other, survival being one of them, prosperity another, security another. Those are legitimate reasons to interdepend, but make no mistake, we're separate, autonomous, different human beings who will never be on the same page, will only approximate each other's minds. That's as good as it ever gets. Any other illusion is an illusion, that we're of the same mind, that we're soulmates, we're the same people, no. That we think the same, no. That we'll always have the same interests, not a chance. that we really understand each other completely and fully, never. We only approximate that enough to get along. But we respect each other's differences, and therefore we work with each other to make it right with each other so that we're both good. And that is a real interdependent relationship where you go, I go. If you're unhappy, that's a problem for me. If you feel something's unfair, that's a problem for me. I have to make it right because we're tied together based on purpose and interdependency. Therefore, we have to move together or we can't move.
Is it right to say somewhat that relationships don't just happen naturally? Like of this order, of this caliber, of this degree, you often say that this is ultimately like a decision and that it's like a moral decision too, which is an interesting word to use. It's a very intense word to use.
It's self-serving. It's actually everything we do is actually selfish, even altruism. Sorry, My safety depends on you as well. Therefore, it's self-serving to make sure you're A-okay, otherwise I'm screwed. Everything we do collaboratively should have a self-serving purpose to it. Otherwise, I'm going to resent you. So agreements have to serve the self as well as the other, or it won't work. If it just serves the other, I'll hate you for it and you'll pay for it. If it just serves me, the reverse will be true. Either way, we suck and we won't make it. So there's a, always the self is involved in everything, and that's important. So it's a very reasonable, understandable, impersonal, fact of nature. You play fair or you're going to have trouble. A relationship, a love relationship, represents a home. Is it going to be the home that you grew up in, or is it going to be the home that you both want? And that's a decision that people will make or they won't make it. And so we're pulled to the other person based on recognition, based on attachment needs, because we need to be attached to one person. We need a secure attachment in order to survive this life. We know this for a fact, that well-being, longevity, happiness, health, mental and physical, depends on the existence of at least one secure attachment in our life. That has been studied for decades, and we know it. So there is a biological need to attach, and that biology is an imperative, which we confuse with love. So people get together and they get attached, and even though the relationship is horrible, what holds them together isn't love. They say, oh, but I love her, I love him. No, the attachment bond is the I can't quit you imperative. I can't quit you, because attachment is an existential fact for human beings. We need to know that this relationship will exist tomorrow, or we feel we will die. Mm. This goes back to infancy. This goes back to a very primitive, primordial, biological experience of death. And that's why I can't quit you. And that becomes a very big problem, because it's not principle-based, it's feeling-based. All other unions, you know, you go into business with someone, you quit the partnership, you're not going to feel you're going to die. And so you can do that if it's unfair, right? You can fire employees. You can, you know, break up with a friend. You're not going to die. But in primary attachment relationships, it's a different biology. And we confuse it with love. And once we're attached, breaking up is really hard to do. Mm-hmm. Mm. And that's good news, because it keeps families intact. It keeps us, you know, connected. It's there for a reason, but it's a problem when a relationship is truly awful and something must be done in order to remedy it.
Stan, I wanted to ask you, you do some like marriage counseling. Are there couples when there isn't like abuse with a capital A, but the incompatibility is so strong, or like, when would you advise a couple to call it?
I don't advise a couple ever to call it, because who am I to do that? I don't want that responsibility, and it's not my life. But I will set the stage to make it impossible to think otherwise, because, well, I mean, my job is to present reality, mm-hmm. and then to expect or to have faith that people will eventually see reality as is and see that they have no choice. It's a painful experience, and I can relate to it, but reality is the safest mother. Mm-hmm. And so the only reason two people would be incompatible would be that they absolutely want two different things that are non-negotiable. That's the only incompatibility. So I want polyamory, you want monogamy. Well, that's a deal breaker. We can't go on, because we'll be pointing in two different directions and we'll fight over everything. Mm. You want had to have a baby. You have to have a baby. I never want to have a baby. Now let's buy a house. That's what people do. Seriously, that's what people do.
Interesting.
They look at the abyss, which is the end of their relationship. They go, let's get married. And that's a deal breaker that exists as a cancer cell that's going to cause a lot of fighting, because they're incompatible, not the people, but what they want. And so I would say the only incompatibility in unions is pointing in two different directions. It's not personality or interests. It really isn't. Mm-hmm. People have been getting together who are different since the beginning of time. The difference does not an incompatibility make, but shared vision and purpose and direction, that is the deal maker. Everything else can be dealt with.
That was very clear. Thank you for sharing that.
So you talk, there's a couple things I'm thinking of. A, you know, for those of us, which is all of us, you know, not used to thinking of relationships this way, where's the space for romance and spontaneity and all that fun stuff that we come to expect? But then also, I have a personal...
In the beginning.
In the beginning, great. How long does that last? And can we bottle it? And can we just make movies about it endlessly and never explore the
ritual please beyond? Do not send this message.
Romance is fine. I mean, all this is fun. It's great. I mean, it's life. It is what makes life... I'm a romantic to the bone. But I also understand that romance can only really exist in a relationship that has a sound structure. Otherwise, romance is the first to die. Mm. And so good feelings are going to be killed if there's a threat in the system. You can't be happy if you're under fear. And so threat is the very first thing that has to be eliminated or mitigated, because a system that is unsafe or insecure cannot be happy. So no matter how you cut it, no union can exist in the long term if there's the existence of threat, which will build and accumulate until biologically people cannot even be in the same room without their heart rates racing. That's just going to be a hard, cold fact. That's a two-person failure. Pox in both their houses. They let that happen because they didn't put anything in place. It was a lawless society, and you get what you pay for, which was not much.
I want to go back to something you said earlier. You said that human beings generally and in relationships are fundamentally self-centered.
Human beings are so annoying.
Basically. I was like, oh my God, no, that stresses me out. The idea that we're fundamentally self-centered. Actually, I think I agree with that our base nature is to be self-centered. But I also
put you under enough stress and you'll see it for yourself.
Yeah. I do believe that, but I also want to believe that we are capable of acting not in our self-interest. And I had one specific question, because you'd given an example earlier about a two-person system that is interdependent. And if one person in that system is upset or sad or frustrated, that if you're interdependent, that becomes a problem for you and you want to fix it. And so how is that self-centered? I'm wondering.
Well, empathy, if you really look at the neurobiology of empathy, true empathy is I literally feel your pain. There are areas of the brain that are actually feeling your pain as if your body's my body. That's not fusion. That's just the way the brain works, certain areas. And so my wanting to make you feel better is also relieving myself. Mm-hmm. If I was in relationship with you, Sophie, and you were in distress, and we did a blood urine analysis of me, I would also be showing stress hormones, mm-hmm. even though I say I'm not, I'm fine. Mm-hmm. So there's the psychological idea that I'm okay, but then there's the biology that suggests that we're actually interconnected. Mm-hmm. Where you go, I go. But even strangers can affect us. Have you ever been around somebody who's just so depressed and you walk away depressed?
Yes, yes. Mm.
Stan, I actually wanted to say something to this selfish, selfless thing, because when you were sharing it, I was thinking that one way of looking at it is, oh, like we're so selfish. But I was thinking that it speaks to something really beautiful about human nature, that what's in our best interest is the prosperity of others. And that like leads to your well-being. I don't necessarily conceive of as selfish, but actually it proves to me that when we're outward looking, when we're concerned with others, when we're not just thinking about ourselves and what we want in a particular moment, but if we can like broaden that to like, what does my partner want? What will bring health to my community? We'll be much happier. I think that's beautiful. I think that's something amazing about human nature.
It is. But there's another aspect here, and that's Schadenfreude. And that is that envy that I relish in your failure. So you know, everything cuts both ways. All the features of the human capacity is also contains bugs. Mm. Knowing what's missing and what I don't have is a bug in my not feeling grateful for what I have and always feeling like I'm missing something and being bummed out and disappointed. But it's a feature in survival by knowing what I need to go out and get. Mm. So everything we have that's a feature that's human is also a bug. My point is get to know how it's a bug and build in something. So you're just not, naive and going, la-di-da, I believe in the best in people. Yeah, we'll also believe in the worst and plan for it. Otherwise, you're going to get the worst because
that makes
we're
sense.
Human. Yeah. For instance, our ability to think critically is used rarely throughout any day. Mostly, we are thinking heuristically. In other words, we're taking problems and we're applying what we already know, which is coming to the most simplest assumption of what is true. That's not critical thinking at all. So since we know this, we can be sure that we're going to make errors of attribution constantly with our partners. We're going to assume that you're doing something based on what you did before, which is false. We're going to assume that we're being clear in our communication, which is not true. We're going to assume that we understand what you just said, which is not true because I probably didn't even hear you. We're going to assume our memory is right, which is never is, but we'll fight over it. And we'll argue about our perceptions, which is stupid. So because our perceptions are constantly being altered by our state of mind. Most of everything we think is true isn't, but because human beings are arrogant and our hubris is that we believe our perceptions, our memory, our communication is perfect, yours isn't, we fight needlessly. These are errors in the mind, in the brain, that are common and across all human beings. And yet, you know, we don't know this, and so we beat each other up over it.
Stick around. We'll be right back. What are some of the most common characteristics of happy relationships that you've noticed? And especially like early on, what are the habits that couples can develop?
Yes. How should we set up shop? Okay. So let's take my wife, Tracy and I. We have built this up over the years and we're awesome. We are constantly pushing and limiting each other throughout every day based on agreement and permission because it gets things done. And we know that we're annoying and we know that we do things that we limit each other and push each other to do because I'm lazy. But we are focused on doing things and focused on problems. We don't focus on each other. That's number one. So as soon as we focus on each other, we're going to be in deep doo-doo and we're going to be spending all our time arguing. We fix things within 30 minutes after a breach of any kind. That doesn't mean that we resolve it. It means that we let each other know that we're okay. I hate your guts right now, but we're fine. I want to punch your face, but we're good. So Tracy and I have this agreement that we can go to bed angry, but we at least have to touch toes. And so, there was a few nights ago, I was so angry with her. And when she gets tired, she just goes to sleep. And so she's just started
nodding. That's crazy. That is so weird.
She's the ever ready bunny. She's love on that. It, she's up, and then that's it. Yeah. And so she started going to sleep and I was sitting up and she was lying curled up and I just wanted to murder her. And and then I remembered our principle that we've at least got to touch toes. And I was still, I could feel every core in my body just not wanting to do it. And then I also thought, okay, one, there's no upside here. I'm suffering. I'm going to have a very bad night. I'm the only person who's suffering. She's sleeping soundly. So that's self-harming. That's dumb. There's no upside here. No upside. So I reached over and I grabbed her hand and I squeezed it. She squeezed it back and I felt this immediate relief. It all went away.
Wow.
I could feel like crying right now, but it all went away because I did that simple act and I suddenly was fine. And not only that, I felt really proud of myself for doing the right thing. It had a self-esteem hit of character that I overrode a base instinct of mine, which was to be right and to punish and to be angry rather than do what was best. And I overrode it and it was all upside. Now that's, can I swear?
Yeah.
Sure.
That's fucking awesome, folks.
Yes.
Stan, when you were talking, I was dying, like writhing in my seat, because I feel like you were describing me and David. And just last night, actually, I was upset with David. And we have an agreement that when I'm upset, specifically me, when I'm upset, I can just let it sit for a while and, you know, stomp around. And the principle for us is I need to just explain, like, hey, I need a couple minutes, or I'm trying to figure out what I'm feeling. But last night, we went down to do the laundry. Well, I went to go do it. And then he's like, I'll come with you. And I was like, I don't need you. But he came anyway. And I was in front of him. I didn't want to look at him. And I was the whole time going down, we were silent. And I was thinking, I need to just say it. I need to say it. I need to say it. Say it. Say it. Say it. And I could not say it until David finally was like, do you need a couple moments? It's like, yes.
David is beet red right now, by the way. It's very cute.
But is there a way to shorten that time frame? Like what you were describing of knowing that you should touch toes, or you should touch your wife, Tracy, but feeling like I want to be right and having
it's stubbornness.
That, yeah. Is there a way to get rid of that?
This is where two people can do things one person can't. So I'm an idiot in so many different ways, and I can be an asshole in so many different ways. But my wife is a good handler of me. She knows how to handle me. I know how to handle her. And being each other's whispers is a worthwhile endeavor. And yet partners don't learn it. They don't do it, mostly because they don't think they should. But that is exactly what they should be doing. And your partner can help you when you can't. Mm. As long as there is prior agreement and permission to do so. Everything has to be done with prior agreement and permission. I give you permission to cue me, prompt me, remind me, and then I will cooperate, yield, and change my attitude. That is a life-saving thing. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I can perseverate and beat a dead horse, and my wife Tracy knows that, and when she sees that I'm doing it, she'll redirect me. And I will cooperate because I know that there's nothing more to be gained by obsessing. And I'll gladly do it with her and then change channels and change my attention. That gets me out of my loop. Mm-hmm. Two people can do amazing things together if they're cooperating with each other and they're agreeing that, you know, watch my back, I'll watch yours. So when making agreements of this kind, the only thing that will get people in trouble is when reminded they don't yield. Mm-hmm. Because then it enters into whether I can trust you or not, whether you're governable. Mm-hmm. Because if you say, well, I couldn't, I didn't feel like it, we have a problem because you're not telling me you can't be governed. And if you can't be governed, I can't be safe in the foxhole with you. Therefore, I'm out.
You're talking about like something of human invention, which grounds us all in the same principles, which will allow us to like practice this in a large scale. Because as is evident, you can barely do it with two people, let alone how many? 7 billion? 11 billion by the end of the century? Yeah. Like, do you see this practice on a large scale?
We start the smallest unit, and that starts with the couple, which bleeds to the family, which goes to the neighborhood, which goes to the community, which goes, right? That's all we can do. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all on this ride together and we only have so much agency. But pick your battles, and certainly one to begin with is home, mm-hmm. right?
It sounds like you do see us overcoming this ultimate urge or impulse, overcoming our automaticness, those automatic responses.
To some degree.
But to some degree. But the point is that if you can't do it, first step, small step, in your closest relationships, there's no hope of doing it outside of those.
Right. It's a worthy practice, because what else are you going to do?
That's true.
Mm-hmm. There's nothing else to do. I mean,
we watch TV, you know what I mean?
Right. But we need people. Relationships are the center of our universe. It's the only thing we lament on our deathbed, if we lament anything. It's not it's where we didn't travel. It's who we fucked and we didn't repair. The relationships that we lost because of our own doing. And so if we know that, then we put value on relationships first, as it should be. And that's really, I think, an important center that we forget, which is why I work with couples as an intervention for children, because couples are influencing their children and their people in their orbit. And so it's a great place to work, because they're leaders, they're exemplars for how to do relationship. Mm-hmm. And if they're doing it well, that's awesome. And people will flock to those couples. They're called mentor couples. They've been there throughout history. People want to be near them because they want to know how to do it. Mm. That's my mission. That's our mission, my wife. That's our sort of our ministry. And that's what we want to do. Mm. Think of it this way. If one partner goes down, the other one there picks them up. Mm-hmm. If one member of a team falls, the other members of the team pick them up. So there's always the opportunity in communion to help each other because none of it's permanent. We can all fall. We can all do the wrong thing. But this is where community, this is where we help each other because we all are wanting the same thing. But that's important. We are wanting the same thing. We want peace. We want to get along. We want to feel safe. We want to prosper. But we do it together. There's no self-made person. That's a fallacy. I am made by other people, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so but that way of thinking is a different way of thinking than the way we commonly, especially in the West, think. Mm-hmm. So yes, nothing's permanent, and we're all going to do the wrong thing at different times. But we're buoyed and we're helped by our partners, by our family, by other people, if we're focused in the same place. So we're looking to the same thing, not me, my, and I, or you. It's we and us.
Mm, that's beautiful.
We and us.
That feels like the perfect place to end, but we do have a standard question that we use to end the podcast. I still want to ask you, if you could speak to both Stan and Tracy in middle school, what would you say to them?
Well, I would say to Stan, sweetheart, I'm so sorry. I know how lonely and how insecure and how ugly and fat and stupid you feel. You're not. Mm. And you're okay. That's the first thing I'd say. And to Tracy, God, you're awesome. Even when you were there, you were just this beautiful filly of a blonde with pronated feet that I still love and adore. And I truly admire my wife. She is actually who she seems. And she would say the same about me, but I do truly feel that way about her. She's annoying as shit, but I'm a lucky, lucky person.
Well, I think that's a beautiful, hopeful place to end it. Thank you, Stan, for
your time.
Yeah.
Thank you all. It was lovely. I had so much fun.
Oh, good.
I'm so glad.
It was so much fun.
We'll leave you with today's listener-submitted middle school memory, a rom-com-ready gem that we've titled Love Comes Around. Enjoy.
I moved out of the big city in eighth grade into a small-town country school. I was so out of place, but one day, in third period, the gorgeous Brad Ballinger introduced himself, and I was in love. He was beautiful, funny, sweet, affable. In my eyes, he was perfect. And I was in trouble. I thought there was no way he would ever want to date me, a skinny city girl with a mouthful of braces. So we didn't date, but we became best friends all the way through graduation. Sadly, after that, we mostly lost touch. And you know what? I never told him how I felt. We both lived our lives. We married, we had children, and at our 20-year high school reunion, I met his wife. She was gorgeous. I was dejected. By then, I was a divorced mom with two babies, doing it all on my own, with only my mother to help me. And I decided I'd rather keep my best friend than keep a flame going for someone I couldn't have. So I let it go and pushed my love for him down and buried it deep. We continued to go through life's ups and downs, both experiencing tragic losses, but our friendship was renewed. And then, 2015, I get a phone call I will never forget. Brad was getting a divorce. He told me the whole story, and it was a bad one. Trust me. So I helped him through it for 8 months, talking to him, listening to him cry, vent, yell. Until one day, he stopped crying, venting, yelling. He was laughing again and happy. One night on the phone at 3 a.m., I finally confessed that I'd had a crush on him since eighth grade. He asked me why I'd never told him, and I explained my insecurities. Brad told me that when his divorce was finalized, I'd better not be seeing anyone because he wanted to be able to take me out. We had our first date in October 2016, and on October 28th, 2017, we got married. The skinny city girl with a mouthful of braces and the gorgeous country boy from third period finally got their happy ending.
You can keep up with Dr. Stan Tatkin and his work at the PACT Institute by following him online at Dr. Stan Tatkin. Podcrushed is hosted by Penn Badgley, Nava Cavillin, and Sophie Ansari.
Our executive producer is Nora Ritchie from Stitcher.
Our lead producer and editor is David Ansari.
Our secondary editor is Sharaf Entwistle.
Special thanks to Peter Clowney, VP of Content at Stitcher, Eric Eddings, Director of Lifestyle Programming at Stitcher, Jared O'Connell and Brendan Brines for the tech support, and Shruti Marate, who transcribes our tape.
Podcrush was created by Nava Cavillin and is executive produced by Penn Badgley and Nava Cavillin and produced by Sophie Ansari. This podcast is a Ninth Mode production. Be sure to subscribe to Podcrush. You can find us on Stitcher, the SiriusXM app, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. If you'd like to submit a middle school story, go to podcrush.com and give us every detail.
And while you're online, be sure to follow us on socials. It's at Podcrush, spelled how it sounds. And our personals are at Penn Badgley, at Nava, that's Nava with three N's, and at Scribble by Sophie. And we're out. See you next week.
Dr. Stan Tatkin, a psychotherapist, researcher, and best-selling author whose work helps us understand all types of relationships in refleshing... I keep saying refleshingly.
Are you a cannibal now?
Because of the role you're in. Yeah.
Refresh.
Stitcher.